Part 5 of 6 from set number 1009, a supplement to Jung's 7 Sermons to the Dead, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Abraxas Amulets in Image and Reality. Illustrated with images viewable with your web browser. See the related HTML web style pages files.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, this is a little two-part program series that we are conducting this Friday and the following Friday. And this Friday is primarily devoted to the showing of a number of original Gnostic talismanic gems in photographic form. And the next week, a week from tonight, I will have just a talk without the pictures on the figure of Abraxas, about which I'll be able to see only very little tonight. And with that, I believe we can proceed with this evening's program. The reason for this program, or let's say the circumstances which made it possible, have to do with the fact that we have a friend in a distant state who wishes to remain anonymous, who has loaned us from his own collection, or I think he pretty much loaned us his entire collection of Gnostic gems for our inspection. And they consist of 4 magnificent ancient pieces, the family of 4, which you see there. In addition to these 4, there is also another piece which the same generous friend, whom we have never met personally, had presented me with as a gift a number of years ago, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 years ago, and which is in a special receptacle, but which will also be shown. Plus, we will have fairly well-known piece of a Gnostic gem which belonged to the late Mr. Manly Palmer Hall, and in fact it's the one which for several decades he has worn as his ring, always. We will see that also. But now, by way of introducing this, I want to say a few words about Gnostic talismanic gems, and then we will look at the various gems themselves, and to the extent that I can, I will try to explain what is on them. Gnostic stones with characteristically Gnostic designs and inscriptions have been discovered in Egypt and other places of the Mideast for quite a long time. But for the most part, people didn't know what to do with them, except perhaps to pick them up and put them in their collections, since they considered them more or less valuable antiques. Their study and their explication had to wait quite a long time. In fact, it was in 1864 that there appeared the first book in England which dealt in a scholarly and sympathetic and understanding manner with the Gnostic talismanic gems. It was a book entitled somewhat ironically, The Gnostics and Their Remains. I always felt it should have been written by an undertaker. But by remains, they meant not mummified bodies of Gnostics, but rather the talismanic gems. The author of the work, C.W. King, a scholar of Trinity College, Cambridge, was an open-minded scholar of what was then known of Gnosticism, which wasn't all that much. And more importantly, he was a devout student of ancient gemstones, not only of the Gnostic variety, because he had also written an other book entitled Antique Gems and Rings, in which he wrote primarily about the nature and the use of talismanic gems in the Roman Empire. In his book, which I mentioned earlier, The Gnostics and Their Remains, he wrote extensively about many talismanic gemstones of the Gnostics. And King was really the first one to call attention to these so-called remains of the Gnostics, and to do so in a sympathetic and informed manner. Because he tried to, and he did his best to explain the teachings, the symbolism, and the mythology of the Gnostics in order to explain the arcane symbols of the designs. And so his book was really not only a book concerning the stones, but really also concerning Gnosticism. It was a very pioneering work. He might be considered then really as the first representative of Gnostic archaeology. The only other work comparable in that regard having been written by the French scholar Chifflet, published in 1617. So the 1617, from 1617 to 1864, there was nothing written on this subject at all. Now, since King's book, there has been an increasing interest in these gems, and today, of course, with the aid of the now available Nag Hammadi Gnostic books and the resurgence of scholarship regarding Gnosticism, we have much more useful information on the subject than before. Now, a few key elements need to be considered. First, what is a talisman or an amulet? Definition of a talisman, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is an object engraven with figures or characters to which are attributed the occult powers of planetary influences and celestial configurations under which it is made. Not a very helpful definition for our purposes. Term talisman originates in the Greek word telesma, which very vaguely means a consecrated object. The other related word comes from the Latin amuletum, an amulet, which is defined as something worn about a person as a charm or a preventive against difficulties, against evil, mischief, disease, hexes, witchcraft, and so forth. Now, both of these definitions for our purposes are rather inadequate. I would suggest that there are really three uses of talismanic and amuletic objects. The first is the one that these dictionaries capitalize on, namely protection against evil. Whenever you see a movie about Dracula, or even about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of my absolute all-time favorites, and so forth, then of course you will see that in the objects used by the Vampire Slayer and others are things that will keep vampires away, primarily crosses and crucifixes. But of course, while that is not an untrue recognition, protective objects of various kinds exist in all traditions, probably one of the oldest being in the Jewish tradition, the amulets against Lilith. Because Lilith, the legendary first wife of Adam, who became the queen of the night demons, threatens small children, and she's sort of an original lady vampire, and so over the cradles certain specific amulets would be hung to keep Lilith away. Also, within the magical tradition, we have the protective pentagram of Solomon, which is worn by a lot of people today, some of whom perhaps don't even know why they are wearing it, but it just looks okay. So there is definitely the protective element. But there is also, there are two more. And I think the second of these is probably more relevant to our purposes, because I think amulets and talismans exist in order to link the individual by way of a symbol with the power symbolized. And here, of course, the whole issue comes up of what is a symbol. And we certainly don't have the time to explicate that to any major extent. But we need to remember that the symbol is not a mere sign, but that it is a cipher to a mystery. It is a sort of an opener of the way, a key whereby one enters a deeper reality. And indeed, it has been recognized as such by modern depth psychology, especially by the psychology of C.G. Jung. So when an amuletic or talismanic object then has such a symbolic value, then it represents a psycho-spiritual link with a non-material reality. And this is not... I think anything so far-fetched, because certainly it is in that manner that innumerable people use the cross or the crucifix of Christ, that the Buddhists use representations of the Lord Buddha or of the Dharma Chakra and other forms which are called rupas, because the rupa represents the arupa. The form represents the formless reality. Similarly, the mezuzah, the chai, which is the word for life in Hebrew, the medals of the Blessed Virgin, of the saints, all of these exist for the purpose of linking the person with the reality that they symbolize, and only in a secondary fashion as a matter of protection. The third is somewhat derivative, and that is the presence of amuletic objects as signs of recognition. For some centuries at least, members of secret fraternities and lodges would wear some symbols which identified them primarily to other members of such associations, and thereby they would be recognized. Probably the such symbols most frequently seen are those of modern Freemasonry, the most prominent of which being the square and the compass, which you see around here quite a bit. Now, Freemasons were, of course, present in Europe. That's where they came from. That's where they came to America from. And certainly there were Masons around, say, when I grew up as a child. But owing to the much more closely observed secrecy there, the Masonic emblems were heavily disguised. And so you would have a gentleman maybe with a very heavily ornamented keychain with one or two medals on it. And if you looked very, very close, then among all kinds of floral ornamentation or something like that, you could see the square and compasses, but you had to know. Along with grips and passwords and other things of that sort, these amuletic talismanic objects, certain ones, serve that purpose. Now, when we go back into classical antiquity, and that is really what we are interested in, because the particular engraved stones that we shall be observing shortly go back to what is often called late antiquity, or the latter part of the ancient world, the Alexandrian period. But in antiquity, particularly in the Roman Empire, it is rather well known that ornamental jewelry was almost always combined with mystical and magical properties. People seldom wore jewelry just as an adornment, but they wore it as an adornment and also for mystico-magical, for its mystico-magical properties. First of all, the most common of these ideas was always that the very stones themselves had special properties. For instance, I wear a rather large amethyst, as you know, but the original magical property, as it would have been recognized in the ancient world and then later on in the Renaissance also, that the amethyst is a defense against poisons, including drunkenness. For instance, they would put amethyst crystals into a chalice, into a goblet or whatever, and then pour wine over it. And that way you could drink a lot and you wouldn't get drunk, at least so they thought. I have found it to be very effective against getting drunk, primarily if one drinks little. But let's say in the same manner, all kinds of stones were associated with their own magical properties. In the Middle Ages, these ideas about magical properties of stones came to be combined with the Kabbalah. Each sephira, for instance, has its own stones, at least two of them, a precious one and a semi-precious one. I'm certainly not going to go through them here, but as an example, let's say Keter, the first and topmost sephira, has as its precious stone the diamond, and as its semi-precious stone the rock crystal, which probably would endear the sephira Keter to all the new ages with their crystallomania, and so forth. The Gnostic talismans, on the other hand, don't seem to be based primarily on the nature of the stone itself, but rather on the design carved in the stone, somewhat like signet rings in later times. You know what a signet ring is? They also come down from earlier times when a lot of people would have their coat of arms, which is the symbol of their family, and that would be then carved into a stone so that you could press it into sealing wax and make a seal with it and thereby identify a particular letter as your own. You know, the use of the envelope is a relatively recent one, and in olden days people had pretty heavy paper or parchment, and they wrote on it, and then they folded it in with the four corners and put the seal in the middle. So it's like a signet ring where the a design is carved into the stone itself. The material of the Gnostic and talismanic stones is therefore of some interest. Scholars tell us that the most frequently used material is dark green jasper from Egypt, which is often mottled with yellow and red, the plasma stone, which is a variety of quartz, usually green, faintly translucent, chalcedony, the red stone hematite, which is a form of iron ore, amber, which is used more rarely, and some others. The materials seem to be chosen mostly for their suitability for carving, which is understandable. However, as a Gnostic, some other thoughts arise in my mind also, which I think have some merit, namely that Gnostics, being the very opposite of materialists, would not wear a talismanic stone for the material that it is made out of, even if that material had magical properties. The linkage of the stones with the planets and later on with the sephirot would not be considered very spiritually useful to the Gnostic, because the Gnostic wants to get away from the power of the planets. The planets are archons, at least to a major extent. And we are here to overcome not only the earth upon which we walk, but to overcome the world, the cosmos. Sapiens dominabitur astris, the wise shall rule over the stars. The Gnostic uses a material which is suitable to the purpose, but the important thing is the transcendental symbol that is carved on the stone, which, and these symbols point to a transcosmic and transcendental processes, beings, and possibilities. The Gnostic gems certainly vary in size and shape. Many are oval, from about 3/4 inch to 1 or 2 inches in their longer dimensions. Some of the stones are decorated and inscribed on one side, but occasionally on both sides, and pretty much all of the ones that we have here, with perhaps the exception of one, are inscribed on both sides. Sometimes when the stone is suitable and large enough, small lettering may be found inscribed on the sides or the edges. The thickness generally varies from 1/16 inch to approximately 1/4 inch. In the earlier books, you will find a bit of incorrect information, well, quite a bit of incorrect information, but I'm just alluding to one here, namely that in the majority of cases, the workmanship is not very good, that these were made at the time when the arts of the ancient world were declining already, poppycock. As you will see in some of these, the workmanship, certainly the workmanship is sometimes primitive and sometimes excellent and highly sophisticated. Why should that be so? Well, I think the common sense would declare that the poorer people were content with having less skilled craftsmen do their stones, and the richer ones retained the services of a master carver. We don't know if the carvers were mostly Gnostics as well as the wearers, but they certainly might have been. Now, a little more. The nature and the purpose of the symbolism. Once again, as a practicing Gnostic, I feel rather convinced that the principal purpose of Gnostic gems was to link the wearer with transcendental principles. By way of the inscribed magical words, often called barbarous words, and that is not a put-down word, but it is a technical word, meaning a word that does not translate into any known language. The barbarians were people who spoke a language that the Greeks didn't understand, and therefore the Greeks thought that their speech sounded like bar, 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 bar. That is all that means, that it is not a language. The amulets may have served as sort of reminders of prayers and invocations. In other words, you might look at your amulet and see the particular formulae, the particular barbarous words, the chants, the lettered there, and then you could chant them. Rather, the same principle as, let's say, using the beads of a rosary. It's a mnemonic device to remember certain prayers and incantations. So it is possible that people were reminded of what they were to recite or chant. It is not at all likely, in fact, that these devices were signs of recognition worn for identification to others. First of all, as far as we are able to determine, these stones were worn at the time when there was no persecution of Gnostics. So there was no need for secrecy. I think to sort of see these in a kind of Masonic light is largely the projection of 19th century writers who were Freemasons themselves and who thought people in the 3rd century followed the same customs as they did. Protective uses there may have been, but more in a derivative sense. such as that good wards off evil, symbols of divine beings keep demons at bay, symbols of liberation control the archons. Another word, and then we will start looking at the stones. It may be good to say a few words in advance before we actually observe them, concerning the symbolic figures on the stones. The majority have as their main or only figure the celebrated Gnostic mystical figure Abraxas or Abrasax. For this reason, the gems have been called generically Abraxoids, meaning Abraxas-like objects. Occasionally there are some other figures. Most frequently, and we have one like that, we will see it, most frequently we find the late Egyptian, by which in the late Egyptian period, the Greco-Egyptian period, deity Harpocrates, a derivative of Horus, that's where the Har comes from, who is the god of secrecy and of the guardian of mysteries. He always holds his finger to his mouth. That's how you can see Harpocrates, indicating keep the secret, keep the secret. And that is a rather good Gnostic admonition, because if as a Gnostic to tell people generally what you're into, the esteem in which you are held is not going to increase. It is likely to decrease. And so it's a good thing to keep one's counsel if one does this sort of thing. There are deeper meanings of it too. If you reveal in hearing of the archons that you are trying to get out of their claws, they are likely to dig their claws more deeply into your flesh or into your psyche, which is even more pernicious. So the Harpocrates, sometimes accompanied by attendants, as we will see one. Abraxas, before I come to Abraxas in conclusion, also at times, we don't have one of those with us now, a serpent with a halo, which is the Nahas, the serpent of wisdom. Also at times a lion serpent, about which I may speak later on. These are the most popular figures. Abraxas we shall deal with, of course, in greater detail in the talk next week, but just very, very quickly, the figure of Abraxas is what the archaeologists and mythologists technically would call by the German name Mischwesen. That's they used in English too. A Mischwesen means a mixed being. A being, that is composed of many different elements. A sphinx would be a Mischwesen, for instance. But this one has the head of a bird, either a rooster or a hawk, depending on the design. Makes no difference. The torso and arms of a human, legs like snakes, most often holding a whip or flail and a shield. The garb seems to be that of a warrior, a military skirt, like they would be worn by soldiers of Rome, and a bare chest, or maybe occasionally even a breastplate. Sometimes Abraxas is shown as a charioteer, riding a chariot with four horses. Let's just say very quickly, as we will do in greater details at some point, that Abraxas, according to the latest researches mythologically, is a son of Sophia. He is the good Archon who has turned to the wisdom of his mother and who has been redeemed, and who therefore stands both as the symbol and the helper of redemption. He has been set above the planets in the eighth region, above the seven planets, the ruler of the seventh heaven, because he has overcome the world. With his rooster eye, he awakens the sleepers. He may be also considered to be composed of the four elements, the bird standing for air, the man for earth, the snakes for water, and the life and the blood within the person for the fire. Thus he is also considered a union of the opposites. It was in that light that C.G. Jung saw him in his famous Seven Sermons to the Dead, where he devoted quite a bit of attention to him. I think that this will give us enough basic background at this point in order to be able to address ourselves to our designs with which we shall now proceed. Here, of course, we have seen the four which have been loaned to us in their frontal view. Abraxas to the right, Abraxas to the left, Abraxas down below. These are all three of them are Abraxas, and the Harpocrates over there, and we will look at all of them in greater detail. And now I think we will go on with some of the others. This is merely one of the stones shown without the intaglio in it, just seen what kind of material the stone is made of. And I think this is the stone of the ring of Mr. Manly Palmer Hall without the inscription, just the stone. There, this is the design of Mr. Hall's ring in the frontal view. To my knowledge, it was acquired by Manly Palmer Hall sometimes in the 1930s in Europe. At that time, it was considered an unusually large Abraxoid, but we will see that some of the ones that we have here exhibiting are very large also. It is of rather crude workmanship. It's very angular, but there is Abraxas. He holds the whip or flail and the shield, which one cannot see all that well, but it is there. And one cannot see an inscription on the shield in this case. The letters which usually accompany Abraxas, the letters E-R-O are, there is the A, there is the O in a rather squarish look, and no doubt the I was somewhere over here, but we can't see it too well. As I say, this is not, certainly not as fine workmanship as some of the ones that we will see. But the essentials of the Abraxas are there, and this is certainly a rooster head rather than a hawk head, because it has a very straight beak, like chickens generally do. You can see his chest is always very muscular, and has strong biceps and strong muscles on his arms, just like a strong warrior would be. And the skirt of the soldier below the waist is there, and then you have the snake, the serpentine legs, which here are very very crudely executed. You can hardly tell that that's a head of a snake, but if you know what an Abraxas generally looks like, then you know what it is like. With that, I think we can go on to one of the others. Now this is the lovely Abraxas in amber, which was given to me, and which is my pride and joy. It's a translucent stone, and for this reason I have had it set in a reliquary which has glass in the front and glass in the back, because that way you can hold it up to the light and then you can really see the intaglio very, very well. It is a typical Abraxas. The only possibly unique feature may be that the serpent legs are coiled, as you can see. In most of the others, they are not coiled like this. On the shield, you have the E-R-O. Again, these are capital Greek letters. But later on, when we find much more elaborate inscriptions, we will see that the language is Coptic rather than just Greek. And the usual rule of thumb is that everything that is written in the capital letters is in the nature of a magical prayer. It is the so-called barbarous words are always in capital letters. And here and there you will find the Greek in the lower key, which will be more like an explanation. So the prosaic part is in regular letters, but the sacred part is always in capital letters. The others are in this one are a little bit unclear. So I will not comment on these because I haven't quite deciphered them yet, but certainly that's kind of where I stop. I have a Greek scholar here. What letter would you associate that one with? These half taus.
Gamma?
That's what I thought. Maybe a capital gamma. And then it would be again, you know, don't look for a rational meaning. That is why these things were looked down upon sort of by a lot of 19th century scholars and so forth, because it didn't make any sense. But let's say not everything has to make sense to the rational mind. Let's say the Gnostic theory was always that these sounds resonate in the higher worlds and evoke a response from there. Now we can go on from there. Once again, we have the family of four which have been lent to us, along with a more recently minted ancient Gnostic symbol, namely a 1937 Indian head nickel, which was placed there for size in order to be able to compare the size. These, as I mentioned before, these are the frontal, the front side, and three of them are Abraxases and one is a Harpocrates. I think that's probably all we need to say about them, but when you see them, you see for instance that one, the round large one, has a hole in it. But that is not the kind of chip or hole that has occurred for by the wear and tear of the ages, but it was punched, and so obviously this was worn probably around the neck as an amulet with a string or some kind of a chain or a thong around it, and they didn't even particularly care that it was in the side. They didn't care which way it hung as long as they could hang it around their necks. None of the others, however, that I recall, have deliberate punched holes in them. This one has, on the front side, has various chips owing to its age, and then another one has a large, the one with the Harpocrates has actually sort of a portion broken off. Of the four, two are oval and two are circular. The really large one in this case are circular in shape, and you can see that the different colored stones that they are made out of. Alright, and I think we can go on from that to another one. And now we see the same family together, including the American Indian head nickel, on the of the reverse side, and we will comment on them in detail. But you will see that of the four, three have only writing. Well, I didn't say only, but have writing on the reverse side. One, two, three. One, however, has a full figure instead of writing on the reverse side. So you can have both, but the more prevalent pattern is that there are additional formulae writing on the and symbols on the reverse side. It doesn't happen so often that you have an actual figure on both sides. Now then we will begin to consider them now one by one. All right. Here we have our Abraxas with the hole punched through it on the side, which for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, but which probably will be revealed later, have been named by my good friend who took these pictures, and so as the heavy metal Abraxas. Now, I don't know whether there is some metal there, or whether he just sort of looks a little bit like he should be a heavy metal figure. That is certainly my suspicion. This is the front size with the Abraxas. You can see that the serpents are not very elaborate, but one can clearly see their heads, sort of dragon-like heads. In other respects, the Abraxas has the usual features. He has the flail or whip over there. It might, I'll reserve what I was about to say. I'll reserve it, I can't reserve it because we have already seen that one. In any event, the description of a rather inept seller, auction house on the amber one that I own now was that he holds, now get this, a boomerang. Mm. Now, a boomerang, as undoubtedly you know, is strictly of Australian origin, and the discovery of Australia was a long, long, long ways in the future when these things were made. So boomerang is certainly highly inaccurate. It's a whip, but also it looks rather like the flail, which is one of the sacred instruments of majesty of the pharaohs. So it has an ancient Egyptian significance, but appears to be the instrument par excellence of Abraxas. So you can interpret it as a flail, you can interpret it as a whip. As a whip, it probably would be the driving on of the energy of the souls to go on to liberation. As the flail, if indeed that's what it is, it could be sort of threshing out the true seeds of light out of the world, just like with the flail one can separate the grain from the straw. So it could very well be both. In any event, he has the shield too, but the shield is rather small and is probably worn off some parts of it so that it cannot be seen that well. There are other designs in the medal, as we really might call this. So it's the heavy medal or the heavy metal. We have a number of designs, and usually, but not always, the sequence of designs or the sequence of writings goes this way, and it usually starts right around there. So we have a tetramorph, a fourfold design over on that side. Next to it, we have a threefold design. So we have a Trinitarian symbol and the symbol of the four. We can only conjecture. With some of the others, we are on safer ground. But we can only conjecture that the fourfold symbol, the tetramorph, is the symbol of the world, earth, water, fire, and air, because the world is composed of these four according to the ancients. that the threefold symbol, the Trinitarian symbol, is the symbol of the human, body, soul, and spirit, or soma and psyche and pneuma in Greek, the human. And then we come now to the celestial part up here. There we have a six-fold symbol, really a six-pointed star, which is often the symbol of the macrocosm of the higher worlds, or the planets minus the seven sacred planets minus the Earth, because the Earth is the one that you take off from, so the other six are over there. And then we have the Ogdoad, or the symbol of the eight, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, sort of drawn like a tree of life, or like a ladder, or something of that sort. And the symbol of the eight, and we will encounter it in other ways later on, is the eight sphere, or the Ogdoad, and it indicates transcendence, transcending the Earth, and then transcending the seven planets. When you have reached the eight, then you are past the limitations of the seven, and you are liberated. You are on the very edge, at the very gate of the fullness of the Pleroma. Those are the symbols that I can readily see. There seems to be something else sort of down toward the bottom. It could very well be a scorpion.
Yeah.
Just what that precisely would mean in this context, I don't think it's the astrological sign of Scorpio. I think it would mean the archonic nature, the nasty nature of the world. And it would probably be a little bit like the many icons of the Virgin where she stands on a snake. So Abraxa stands on the scorpion, on the poisonous, nasty forces of this world. Now I think we'll go on from there, and we will probably see the reverse of this. And this is a very interesting one, because this is the only one in the collection where the reverse has an other figure. It doesn't just have writing. Now this is rather difficult to interpret, because it's not a standard figure. You don't see this often, in fact practically never, in the collections. It is a humanoid figure with six arms, each holding some instrument of power, such as whips or flails over there on that side, several of them, arrow, possibly a dagger or scepter, and also the figure seems to have three heads. A human in the middle, which has a triangular ornament or crown on the at the top of the of his head, and one with a solar crown with spikes looking off in one direction, and the other, when it's enlarged like this, you can see the face fairly well, and it seems to have possibly a lunar crown, a crescent on the head. So they could very well be the sun and the moon on two sides, and then the human in the middle, which would make sense. Of course, the cosmic symbols, or as Mani would call them, the ships of light, but they also could stand for the feeling tone, the emotional lunar nature of psyche, and then the sort of illuminative nous, like the sun of the higher mind. The possible meaning, we just have to conjecture about it. The possible meaning is perhaps the human with instruments of liberation, because Abraxas also holds the flail, and then the arrow which flies through the air rather like the spirit should move through the ethers in order to get up to the heavens, to transcendence. So I would think that it is sort of symbolic of the Gnostic hero, the Gnostic warrior with his various instruments of liberation with which he is fighting for freedom. Possibly the Anthropos, the celestial man among the stars, and certainly there are stars around. They are all six-pointed stars, and there are at least three of them visible, 1, 2, 3. So that might indicate that this being is up in the starry heavens or is traveling through the heavens. There is no inscription visible at all. It is only the figure. So the Abraxas on the one side, and this curious many-armed humanoid figure, maybe somewhat like a many-armed Shiva or some of the many-armed bodhisattvas in Indian lore. And that's probably about as much as we can say about him. Here, this is a smaller stone. It will be clearer. Here we can mainly see the color of the stone and the vague outline of the figure within it. But we will get another picture of it in detail soon. But you can see how different in color, different in constitution these stones are one from the other. They each have a very distinct characteristics, both in terms of the material and in terms of the design as well. What else can I say about it? That's probably pretty much it. Now, I believe that this is the same stone, but illuminated in such a way that we can, from the front, so that we can see the detail. It is, of course, again, our old friend Abraxas with whip and shield. You see, here the whip is really much more like a whip and not like a flail. It goes all the way across. We don't see that flail-like portion hanging down. It's much more like a kind of a horse whip or a kind of a dog whip that one would use. And the shield is very distinct and has a description on it. The shield says A-E-I-O-U-O. Which is a very very typical Gnostic invocation containing the vowel sounds. I-O-U or I-E-O-U-O, ending with the omega again. But this is I-E-O-U-O. Interestingly enough, these vowel sounds, it was remembered later on that there is magic in these vowel sounds, even when people didn't know that they came from the Gnostics anymore. And for instance, the motto of the house, the imperial house of Habsburg, who you know ruled the Holy Roman Empire in Austria for such a very, very long time, underneath the Habsburg coat of arms is A-E-I-O-U, to which various interpretations were given that they are initials of words for a sentence, such as Austria erit in orbe ultima. Austria will be the last one in the world, will be the last one surviving, and so forth. But there is no real proof of that. I think that people knew, even in the Middle Ages, that was some kind of a magic to these words, and they attached it to important people. Now, let's see what else we have on it. On the left side, we have A-E, again, capital letters. Under his feet, E-R-O. And we have E-R-I-A on the two sides. Oh, yeah, don't know. I'm sorry. That's how it is. E-R-O. The O, the omega is down under his feet. On the, to the left is the iota. Here is the alpha, and there is the omega. So E-R-O. And around whatever. it could have, there could have been a design in it, maybe that has worn off, but I doubt it. It could be sort of like a globe, like a ball, like the earth or something of that sort. After all, the round qualities of the earth were often held by people in the ancient world. It was only later on that it was forgotten about and was conceived of as flat. And then the knowledge was recovered again. Now, I think we'll get a look at the backside of our... It's a very nice Abraxas. You know, sometimes he faces one way, sometimes he faces another way. It doesn't seem to make any difference which way he turns his head. But the whip is always in the right hand, the shield is always in the left. Which is understandable, because the weapon would be in the right hand and one would guard oneself with the shield. Okay? Let's look at the next one. Now, this is the reverse side. And what we have here is the famous old Gnostic palindromic name, Ablanatanalba. And some others added to it. The Ablanatanalba is a palindrome, which means that it reads forwards and backwards in the same way, like abracadabra, which doesn't come from the Gnostics, by the way. But since ancient times, palindromes were always considered to be some sort of magical, you know. And Ablanatanalba, again, it doesn't have any meaning, but that should not cause us boredom, because it was considered a very, very high name. And possibly, according to some of the sources, along with Aberramento and some others, a mystical name for Christ, for the Redeemer. See, the Abba, the Abba is all reminiscent of Abba, Father. Some of these come from Hebrew and then they are turned into Greek and Coptic. But of course, Ablanatan Alba, the Alba again would mean white, if indeed that figures in the situation or not. On the edge, there is another inscription which we don't see here, but which we probably will see soon. There is yet another inscription, and Ablanatanalba, and then again, you know, you may wonder, it certainly made other people wonder as to why they had these sounds, but people will see that similarly, sounds without too much regard for some kind of rational meaning are used in many traditions, and they are used for the purpose of what in the East, or at least in India, are called mantras. They are sounds that are supposed to produce a certain result when they are sounded out or when they are chanted. There are more inscriptions on that edge. And in fact, there is an inner and an outer inscription. But again, these are not things that we can translate. And the way I deciphered one at the inner edge Ue, ui, o, hi, a, hi, o, u, o, u, o, u, o. That's one. And then the outer, a, u, re, ui, fa, ta, mi, u, a, i. Deciphered it right. But it, I'm sure you are terribly taken with the meaning of it, and so you'll be very happy with it. Alright, moving right along now. Now we come to the stone, which in our jocular way we refer to as chip. Just like we had heavy metal and we have chip. Well, you can see why chip is chip, because there is a big chip in it. Now, chip is unusual because I hope you are not, but you could be by now somewhat tired of Abraxas, and this is the one that doesn't have an Abraxas on it, but rather it has Harpocrates. You can see this sort of way. This shows, I think, the Egyptian influence a little more than the others. But Harpocrates is sitting on a lotus throne. You can see the lotus buds coming there. If you look at him close, you can see his hand in front of his face with the one finger moving toward his lips, indicating the silence. There we have him much more clearly, you see. He has a spiky sort of solar crown with the rays coming out of his head, also with an orb, which again might indicate the solar orb above his head. He has something very much like a double flail in one hand, which is again a, you know, pharaonic symbol. And therewith he points with his finger toward his mouth, indicating silence. In front of him, facing him, stands a baboon, the dog-headed, the cynocephalous baboon, the dog-headed baboon. And he also has a solar orb over his head. Sacred baboons or baboon deities were rather popular in Egypt. Probably the one god who always had one following him around being Thoth, the ape of Thoth, is sort of his servant. But we have one here. He has a nice baboon tail hanging down there. His two hands are up, sort of in a supplicating or saluting manner, and he has a rather prominent and very erect phallus. Also sticking out, which is certainly not uncommon with apes, but hair sticking out of him. You can see the, you know, hair coming out in all directions. Trying to figure out why Harpocrates or any other deity should have a baboon with him, at least it's my conviction, that's somewhat sustained by Wallis Budge and people of that sort, so that the baboon often indicated sort of the lower aspect of the god. Because after all, baboons and other monkeys are very humanoid. They look very much like a human, frighteningly so, but they ain't, as one might say in elegant language. There is the animal, the monkey side of us, the monkey mind, and the animal nature. And then there is the god itself. But you see, the animal nature is subservient to the higher nature. The god sits on a throne. The monkey just stands on a kind of a little earth platform, and it could be conceivably the symbol of the lesser, the natural, the animal human serving the greater human, who knows the mystery and who bids everyone to be silent about the mystery. There are inscriptions around and from left to right, I am reading what I deciphered, if I was right, again. I-E-I-O-U-E-O-E-A-O-A-I. That's the first one then. I-E-U-E-U-E-O-O-A-S-A-L-A-E-E. Near where the chip is another one which is probably and a Coptic letter which is something like ps. We will see his reverse side in a minute, in the really spectacular, the most spectacular piece, of course, will be last in this shortly to come. But now we'll look probably at the reverse. There is the reverse side of chip. There are only inscriptions. Usually there are only letters on the reverse side. A, I, A, O, T, E, Tu, Ri, E, Te, To, O, Na, a number of other ones coming down. Again, a magical sentence. And then we will come now to the last and the biggest and the most beautiful of the lot. There he is, front side. In our jocular manner, because of his size and all that, we have referred to this one as Big Mama. So there is Big Mama, obviously on Abraxas, very, very well executed. I don't know whether we probably have another one where we can see the details better, but it's you can. There you are. I mean, look how clear and how beautifully executed this is. It's an unusually beautiful carving job. He holds undoubtedly the flail. It's a little smaller, or maybe the end of it is chipped off. And then the shield. The shield has on it Iao Sabaoth, the complete one. The right hand is raised, holding the flail. Below him is a design which is interpreted by some scholars as a wheel, and it may very well be. But if it indeed is a wheel, it is a wheel with 8 spokes, rather like the wheel of the Dharma in Buddhism, and it may signify a chariot. Instead of putting the whole chariot on which he rides, they just put a wheel. But it may also, in addition to that, or in lieu of, since it has 8 spokes, it may indicate the Ogdoad, that he is in the seventh sphere. To his left is an interesting magical sequence. It starts out A-E-I-O-U-O-E, right? Over there. Then the A drops off, and it's just A-E-I-O-U-E. And then it A-E-O-U-O, and it becomes less E-O-U-O-U-O, and finally on the bottom just O. So it's always one letter drops off and it diminishes, although there's one little glitch there in the middle. But it's one of these magical sequences where you have only one letter at the bottom, in this case the omega, and then it expands and finally becomes the whole sentence. I-A-E-O-U-O-A. No, I-O-U-O. I-O-U-O. The end is an omega. You observe the inscription on the rim, which is quite... There are inscriptions over here too, and then there are many more on the reverse side. And again, the The inscriptions are various magical words, but I think we still have the reverse side to look at. But look at that wonderfully executed piece. This looks incidentally more like the head of a hawk. You can see the beak is curved. It's the hawk's beak rather than that straight chicken beak. But there is an ornament on his head that really could be more like the comb of a rooster. So it's both. It even has the indication of a kind of a robe, a fabric falling down from his shoulder. And then again he has the military skirt, very nicely carved chest and the abdominal area, and even the loop on the shield through which he puts his arm. So it's really very, very detailed. And the snakes are quite impressive too, and there is no mistaking them that they are snakes. And then we'll go on to the reverse side of this, and then we shall be finished. Well, this gives you an indication again of the color of the stone, of what kind of stone it is carved into, what it looks like. And you see it's you can see, of course it's not that thick, but you can see that this is quite a thick stone, and it has that greenish color mottled with other materials. I don't know whether I have a note as to what kind of stone this one is made out of, but it's certainly it's a very, very fine stone with very, very beautiful carving. And I think we'll probably have a clearer one. There we are with a clearer one of the reverse side. And here in the midst of several magical words that have Z in it, which is a favorite one in some of the Gnostic mantras, like Zoa, 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 Zoe, Zao, Zoa, and things of that sort, sort of a buzzing sound. We then have a number of once again we have a sort of a wheel-like symbol. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that one, 6. Something over there that seems like a fourfold symbol. And then we have definitely an eightfold symbol with the moon to one side, probably indicating the Ogdoad. Undoubtedly all of these were quite meaningful to the people who saw them. They knew what they were, and they knew how to use these in order to recite the various invocations. Even if the carver made a mistake and maybe put in an extra letter or left one out, they knew what it meant. And so these are really iconographical and prayerful symbols. So I think that brings us to the conclusion of these. This is about the time when we usually conclude anyway. And I think I will just thank you for your attention and hope that these have been of interest to you. And then we'll go from there. And we'll conclude this part. See, there again are the four, is the family of the four, three Abraxases and one Harpocrates, in a very nice carvings. So thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed this. And also please give a hand, and I certainly express my thanks not only to our kind and wonderful friend who let us borrow these wonderful things, which cost a great deal of money and are very valuable, but also to my friend Brian Campbell, who has so expertly and with so much work arranged this whole show. And I think we really
copyright MMI by BC Recordings, catalog number 100905. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.